Are we ready to go? I guess so. All right. I'm Eric Wolpaw, and I'm a writer at Valve.
I'm Chuck Valsack, also a writer at Valve.
And today we are going to talk about making Portal 2. And because we're going to talk about making Portal 2, I just want to be clear that there's going to be a lot of spoilers in the talk. So if you want to storm out, now would be a good time. Talk's going to be about 30, 35 minutes long, and we want to leave some time at the end for Q&A. So here we go.
Blues Brothers 2000, Ghostbusters 2, and my favorite, Titanic 2. Yeah. These all raise a question, why even make a sequel?
Yeah, sequels get a bad rap, which comes mostly from movies, we think, where sequels rarely work in the first place and are almost never better than the original. Game sequels, though, have a long tradition of actually improving on the original. The reason why, I think, is just because games in general get better with iteration. Most of the first in a series of games tends to not actually capture the vision of the developers. So the good news here is that making a sequel to a game is actually should be a lot easier than making the sequel to a movie.
Unfortunately, we still had a problem. This is a sequel to Portal. Critics and players pretty much thought the game was the perfect length, and most people thought the story was self-contained, and they were just about satisfied with the experience. You know, at the end, we blow up Aperture, and we even kill GLaDOS, kind of. So that leaves us with a problem. We made a game with really no thought of making a sequel or extending the story on how we would go to make about a sequel, go about making a sequel.
And actually, Jay Pinkerton, who's one of the other writers, helped us make this slideshow, and he put these in this morning. These quotes, I'm actually just seeing it for the first time. Could Portal 2's writers possibly top what many consider to be one of the finest examples of modern game writing? In a word, no. So they kind of gave it to us and then took it away there real quick. So why make Portal 2? Well, at Valve, we really just get to work on what we're interested in. And the bottom line was Portal 1 was made by a small team of students that we'd picked up from DigiPen who had made a small demo game called Nerbacular Drop. And so that left like 150 people at Valve who actually didn't get to work on Portal, but who loved Portal. And so after we released the Orange Box, there were just a bunch of people who wanted to work on a Portal game. And honest to God, it was as simple as that.
So then the question is, where do we start? At Valve, we don't create giant design documents. What happened is after the Orange Box, we took about 4 months where the entire company broke into small little groups of about 3 to 4 people, and we did design experiments. And this is, you can kind of pursue whatever interested you, whatever kind of crazy gameplay idea you wanted to explore. And a few of those experiments seemed like they might be a good fit for Portal.
Right, and that's where we started, with a few simple ideas and some goals and constraints. At this stage of a project of Valve, we tend to start with a smaller team. In the case of Portal 2, there was about 15 of us, so that we can kind of poke holes in the concept before we get a big 60 or 70 person shipping team on it. So that's what a group of us did. And after looking at the result of everybody's design experiments and thinking a lot about what a sequel to Portal might look like, we ended up making a few key initial choices. So the first thing was we decided to keep Aperture. Aperture Science seemed like it was the foundation kind of on which Portal was built. From writing perspective, we thought there was sort of unlimited potential there to explore this mad funhouse of science. So, having decided to keep Aperture, here's what we cut from the original version of Portal 2.
So we cut Chell. She got out. Good luck to her. Who needs her?
Right. Who needs her?
Cut GLaDOS. She kind of died in the end, and she had a nice little story arc. It's time for a new villain. And we cut Portals. Sure, the name is in the title, but we figured we would worry about that later.
Yeah,
who needs them? We have a sexy new mechanic.
Super confident in that. So the new mechanic was something that came out of the design experiments, and it was called F-Stop. And this is from our F-Stop Portal 2, our first mock-up of it. This is kind of the room where you were introduced to F-Stop. I'm not actually going to go into the details of the mechanic, because hopefully someday we'll use it again. So in this version, we had a new antagonist, and that was Cave Johnson, who actually ended up showing up in Portal 2 for part of the experience. But in F-Stop Portal 2, He was the whole show. He was the main character. And these are some concepts from when we were originally casting for him. Originally, he was going to be this Southern billionaire, and he eventually kind of transmogrified into the Midwestern millionaire that appears in Portal 2. GLaDOS was not going to appear except in this little cameo where we had this thing called the Gyroscopic Liability Absolver and Disk Operating System, and referred to as Betty. And she would kind of roll out after Cave Johnson would describe a test and quickly rattle off some legalese stuff that would absolve Aperture of any responsibility for the danger you were about to be in. It was like in those ads for medicine where they show puppies while they're talking about the rectal bleeding it's going to cause. So this was also going to be a new era of Aperture that you hadn't seen before. It was all going to take place in the 1980s, about 20 years before the events of Portal 1. And it was all going to be about this robot uprising. You can kind of see these mannequins in the lower right-hand corner having a smoke break. And I found this picture. I don't know what it is. There's a giant chicken running through some offices. I'm not sure what that was all about. But anyway, so it was going to take place in the 80s, and you were going to get to see a whole new part of Aperture before it had actually been destroyed. So this is the very original, the opening sequence of that game, or of the FSOP portal. This is where you're waking up in that version of the relaxation vault, if it plays. There we go. So that was showing some of the transforming environments that we were going to go for in that iteration.
So after about 3 months of working on this, the team felt pretty good. People seemed to like the individual component ideas, but when we had something meaty enough to play test, the constant feedback we got was that it was a lot of things, but it wasn't Portal 2. So lesson one, you don't need to burn everything to the ground. Yep. So some things we added back in, Chell, GLaDOS, and portals.
So in terms of the portals, at the end of development of Portal 1, we had had a few mechanics that we'd been working on, but because of the size of the team, we just didn't really have time to polish them enough to ship. Some things like the light bridge that's shown here and the excursion funnels. And so we went back to these and actually started trying to design puzzles with them and figure out what worked about them.
And so we also went back to GLaDOS. You know, in the last 10 minutes of Portal, she's an interesting character to explore. She's broadened herself at that point. She has more emotions, for lack of a better term. She's become more human. And I think if most people look back at Portal 1, that's the GLaDOS they remember. They don't remember the early robotic GLaDOS. You know, and as writers, we'd lived with her for years. And so, you know, whatever we thought of her, it was a skewed perspective. Most gamers had only lived with her for a few hours, and they were ready for more of her.
So Chell, bringing her back, was kind of the least intuitive piece to us. She's mute. She doesn't really have a character. She's just kind of this physical presence that you occasionally see glimpsed through portals. And honestly, like Chet said before, we kind of felt as writers that she'd had her day. You know, she fought GLaDOS, she escaped, and we just let her be. And we put her, we started this iteration of Portal with you waking up in the relaxation vault, and you were standing in front of a mirror so that you could see that you weren't Chell. You were this other character we called Mel, who had blonde hair and a different colored jumpsuit, and it was pretty obviously not Chell. And to a person, playtesters didn't care. At that point, it did not matter at all to them that they weren't Chell, until the point where she wakes up GLaDOS, and GLaDOS does not recognize her. And what we realized is that Portal 1 was this sort of intimate story about the relationship you had with GLaDOS. And when GLaDOS wakes up and doesn't recognize that you're the person that did these things to her in Portal, it's actually a blow to the player. I mean, this was a place where, to a person, the playtesters were like, ugh, you know, why doesn't GLaDOS know who I am? So Chell went back in.
And then at this point, we also added something new, and that would be the paint mechanic. We had hired the guys who made Tag the Power of Paint back in the Left 4 Dead 1 days, and they actually helped us ship Left 4 Dead 1 and 2. And then they were somewhat independently working on using paint with portals. They showed what they were working on to the Portal 2 team, and we brought them on board. So there you had it. We had our new mechanics for the game.
Yep. So we had added a whole bunch of stuff in, although still cut was the cake. And nope, nobody missed it. So this is where we were at this point after the F-stop was abandoned. Portal 2 would have portals, GLaDOS, and take place in the aperture that players were familiar with from Portal 1. So here is the very first opening of that iteration of Portal 2.
Activated. Hello. You have been detained
in the relaxation vault for 9-0-0-0-4-0.
Sentry mode activated. Target acquired.
Nothing.
Why am I not surprised?
Critical error. Critical error. The usual summon burning.
Wanted to make a game for both new and returning players. We didn't want to force new players to play Portal 1 in order to understand what was going on. Unfortunately, Portal 1 was about 80% training arc. So the challenge we faced when we switched back to Portals was how to compress that and represent it in a way that new players would be up to speed on Portals, but that returning players would still have something interesting going on.
So the good thing is we had some fresh eyes looking at Portal 1's puzzles, and we came up with some clever ways to kind of streamline and combine training. For instance, in its original form, this puzzle, what we call Portal Carousel, required players to wait for the portal to move around the room on its own schedule, and you could see often players wouldn't look at where the portal was coming up. It was just really hard for them to learn and slow to solve that puzzle. And then the new version of this puzzle, of the same map, allowed the players to control the pace by opening up the portal with a button. This not only made the puzzle faster to solve, but by letting players control the appearance of the puzzle, they actually helped understand the new mechanic. It seems pretty obvious, but it's a really big difference between the two.
So another thing we did was improve the game by actually removing one of the features of Portal 1, which was the dreaded plasma ball. I don't know if you remember it, but we replaced it with lasers. The plasma ball had several drawbacks, primarily that there was a long wait after failure before the plasma ball would come back, and also the way it would kind of sneak up behind you and just vaporize you out of nowhere, and players often had no idea why they just died. But lasers had all the puzzle-solving properties of energy balls while also providing instantaneous feedback loop for the player. Because a laser entering one portal and coming out of the other was sort of a permanent fixture until you moved the portal, we noticed that it really, really helped new players sort of understand what portals were doing. The lasers also let us do a few things the plasma balls didn't. For instance, this is the original version of the part of the game where you destroy the neurotoxin facility. So that long, awkward part I just showed you was an accurate recreation of what players did when they went in that room. There's this kind of fundamental, axiomatic, physical principle of gamers that they will never look up at the ceiling. They only look straight ahead, which I guess we should have known. But so here is the actual solution to this. So it was kind of cool, but we were really having a hard time getting people to look up. At one point, we even considered just putting a sign there that just said, look up, which seemed like it was going to ruin the puzzle and just seemed kind of cheap, and we had a rule against doing that. Having said that, we put a lot of time into making the implosion in that room look really cool, and when we discovered people were turning away, not looking at it, we actually did just put a sign in that says, in case of implosion, look directly at implosion. So I guess the design rule there is, don't be a tight ass about your own rules. Just abandon them.
All right, so while we tightened up the Portal 1 training arc, we still needed something more to entertain returning players. And some of what we did was merely cosmetic. For instance, here's the Portal 1 elevators. And then we can take a look at the Portal 2 elevators, and we'll see that somehow destroying Aperture Science gave us all new elevators with video screens around them that showed us cool little transition movies. I mean, there is no logical reason we have new elevators. But players never questioned it, never minded it. And so our thought always was, you know, you don't need to be a slave to the original. If you're improving it, players won't care. And so then we also set the game in some unknown but long amount of time after Portal 1. So that this way, the returning players, they see familiar spaces in an entering altered space or in state. You know, it also let them see their actions in Portal 1. They're the ones who blew up the base. They're the ones who caused all this plant overgrowth and destruction, and they got to witness it. And the altered environments wasn't quite enough to rehabilitate the old space, so we introduced a new character, Wheatley. He gave players an interesting companion, which was the final thing we needed to make the training feel fresh. Luckily, Wheatley solved a few other problems for us. You know, Portal 1's story kind of sneaks up on you. Players aren't sure if it's funny at first. In fact, players don't even know there's a story until about two-thirds of the way through. You know, it's a really good trick, but you can't do it twice. So for Portal 2, we needed to do something new, and Wheatley really quickly helps establish the tone right off. You know it's a comedy. He comes in, you're laughing, it's okay to laugh. The rest of the game, it's okay for you to laugh. And you know, Wheatley also gives players a burst of exposition. And the cool thing here is new players, they get told what happened, and returning players are reminded of who they are, where they are, and what's happening. And for new players, he also restates the entire plot of Portal 1 and provides a brief glimpse into GLaDOS. And that way you also get to know that she's a big deal. And then finally, when you have this likable companion, he also actually lets us demonstrate something else to new players, and that's that GLaDOS is a threat by having her immediately kill him. And that's not a spoiler, because he's not actually dead, and that is the spoiler.
So there was a lot of positive things with Wheatley, but he did cause some problems. The first problem was that we burned a lot of calories making sure you couldn't leave him behind. When we first put him in the game, you spent a lot of time actually carrying him around, and we let you drop him basically at any point. And the main reason we let you drop him was because we were thinking, well, if you can carry him, obviously you ought to be able to drop him. It was just this kind of axiomatic assumption that we made that we never really thought to challenge. The other reason you could carry him dates back to an early prototype sphere that was this paranoid sphere that had carved out a section of old Aperture as his own little fiefdom, and had set up all these defenses to protect it. Unfortunately, all the defenses were pointed in one direction, and Chell could just drop in through a crack in the wall about 2 feet behind him and pluck him off his pedestal. And here is an actual video of that original sphere.
I think I'll just drop right in there. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, well, I guess you won't be doing that, will you? Not here, you won't. Not on my watch, you can see down on that. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. I can make sure you of that.
I'd love to see someone get in here. I'd really love to see that. I am absolutely just teetering on the precipice here, lady. Pull me down or I will go mental and people will get hurt. Off of me.
You're a monster. You're killing me.
Put me down, because I doubt very much that you are prepared for the terrible consequences of me going mental, which I swear to God is this close to occurring. Run!
So that last part at the end where you beat him against a wall and then throw him down the stairs caused us probably about a year of pain and suffering because we liked it so much that we wanted to make sure that you could do it with Wheatley. Unfortunately, being able to drop Wheatley meant that we had to gate the player so that he couldn't just drop Wheatley and then wander off into the rest of the game. And those gates took the form of these doors that Wheatley would have to hack, and they were at regularly scheduled intervals, so you could only get about 20 feet ahead of Wheatley. Implementation-wise, it was a huge pain in the ass. And as the game progressed, the time that you spent with Wheatley off his rail was narrowed down to more or less what it is in the shipping game, which is after he jumps off his management rail and you don't catch him all the way up until the point where you put him in the elevator that leads up to GLaDOS. It's probably about 5 minutes in the shipping game. But having said that, this staircase in the GLaDOS wake-up room is actually only there because we wanted you to be able to throw Wheatley down it. So at some point, fairly late in development, we finally admitted how many problems dropping Wheatley was causing us, and we just decided during that part he was going to stick to your hands like glue. We put it in, and we assumed, because we'd build it so much up in our heads, that playtesters were just going to revolt, and they were going to be trying to throw him down and just be angry, and not a single playtester even cared that you couldn't drop him. None of them even tried. It was just another example of us having these kind of fundamental assumptions that we didn't think to question. The fact that you can't drop Wheatley, if you don't know you can drop Wheatley, nobody misses it. So our second problem with Wheatley rose out of temp audio. So this is Stephen Merchant, who voiced Wheatley. And his sessions happened, and his VO came online, like in the last year and a half of development. Before that, Wheatley's voice was provided by one of our animators, Richard Lord. This is the picture that Richard gave us when we asked him. So, actually gave us another picture of him on the toilet, so you're getting the better one. Richard is a super, super duper smart guy. He designs and animates all the iconographic animations that you see in the elevators and that were in some of our advertising. He's also got this kind of nice voice that people like to listen to. And you heard his voice in the clip of the Paranoid Sphere. So people liked his voice enough that when our first Merchant session got delayed a month right before E3 where we debuted Portal, we decided, what the hell, we'll just play the Richard audio. And people liked it. And people liked it so much that when we finally got world-class comedic actor Stephen Merchant in there, there was this small but very vocal section of our fan base that was just livid, wanted Richard back. And at the end of the day, this is kind of a microcosm of the whole problem with sequels. You know, with nothing to compare it to, the first version of anything can pretty much stand alone. But once you put a replacement in there, there's going to be somebody who prefers it. It's kind of the law of sequels. You just can't win no matter what you do. Well, you can win, but it's sort of like you can't have a flawless victory. So
our last problem was caused by Wheatley dying. So originally, GLaDOS crushed Wheatley right after she wakes up, and that was it. You didn't see Wheatley anymore. You know, he was just dead and gone. And we thought that kind of finality let everyone understand just how evil GLaDOS was. This was back when GLaDOS was still going to be the main antagonist, but the problem was after Wheatley dies, you're going to meet six other sphere personalities, each with their own personality.
And as an example, this is one of the ones, this is some concept art for the somebody we called the Morgan Freeman Sphere. So he'd been sitting on that little pedestal for a few centuries, and he was just incredibly, incredibly wise, but only about the 20 by 20 space that he was trapped in. So as soon as you dragged him 22 feet out of the room, his mind was blown, and he was pretty much useless. Although, as the game progressed, he eventually got his feet under him and started delivering some homespun wisdom that all related back to this little 20 by 20 space that he'd been living in.
So back to Wheatley dying. It certainly worked in the term of making people understand how evil GLaDOS was. They got that. But people missed Wheatley. And with GLaDOS now in the mix, and none of the other spheres really having enough time to bond with the player, we're missing something. Because even in a talkie game like Portal, you're still more or less writing in the margins. And so then our simple answer was, let's just kill Wheatley and then bring him back. You know, we still get all the dramatic benefits of GLaDOS crushing him. Plus, we don't have to throw away all the precious time we'd spend building this relationship between the player and Wheatley. Even better, this led to a bunch of insight that we ought to make Wheatley the antagonist. Because again, before he was just dead and he wasn't going to be the antagonist, and now he's going to be the evil villain for the last half of the game. And a lot of good things flowed from that one assumption. It's another example where we try to solve a problem without questioning the core assumption, and that was not to kill Wheatley, and then what do we do? In this case, let's just kill him and bring him back, and then it's fine. Everything works in retrospect. Okay, and so now we've got a pretty good handle on the single-player game. This is rough, but generally working in terms of plot and structure, and most importantly for what we test is pacing and comprehension. Every play test, we bring people in, we talk about the pacing, comprehension, we make sure we have that nailed, that's working, that's flowing. And the co-op mechanic was working great on its own. Just the puzzles alone were totally fun. So we figured the co-op story was going to be a breeze. Smart thing on our part, we thought, we'd save it to the very end of development. Problem is, we discovered there's a huge difference between telling the Portal 2 story versus the single-player story.
Yeah, since we figured people would play the single-player first, we set the co-op story after the events, a single-player game. And in this original co-op iteration, we actually thought we had a pretty good story going. So with Chell gone, GLaDOS is just prepared to test for eternity with the two co-op bots that we introduced in single-player. Unfortunately, though, she quickly discovers that none of the tests she's doing is providing any data, because without any human observer, the tests are always in this sort of Schrodinger's cat state of quantum uncertainty. Like in this picture, is the cat hanging in there, or is he not hanging in there? Who knows, until somebody looks at it. So what she does is she starts sending the bots into the bowels of Aperture to collect human artifacts in the hope that they will help the bots become more human so she can break through this kind of quantum problem she has. So we actually mock this whole part up for playtesting all the way through the retrieval of the first artifact, which was this Garfield-like cartoon called Dorfelt that some long-dead Aperture employee had tacked up on a bulletin board deep in the bowels of Aperture. The bots find it, they bring it back to GLaDOS, and none of the three of them can figure out what's funny about this Dorfelt. So GLaDOS actually rewrites it to make it funnier. So the first three panels, Dorfelt is sitting next to an empty panel of lasagna, and then his owner comes, and he's really angry that Dorfelt ate the lasagna. And then the owner says that he's activated the neurotoxin emitters, at which point Dorfelt feels regret, but only briefly. So, and just want to mention that Anthony Clark, who goes under the name of Nedroid, originally drew this for Jay and I, like in a day when we were trying to put this together. So, thank you.
So, Nedroid. We had our comic, and we were pretty happy with this direction. But we discovered, as we playtested, is there some fundamental differences between the way the story was going to work for the single player versus the co-op. In single player, you have a captive audience. They will watch intently. They're fully in the moment, and they generally pay attention to the crafted experience. Co-op players, on the other hand, will interrupt your best material to ask each other what they had for dinner. So this means we had to simplify and change how we told the story. And so what we do is we actually repeat the main story points many times in short little bits. That way, if you miss one, you can get it the next time. And this is also different, though, from how we handled it in the Left 4 Dead series, because we do co-op there, and we tell story there. But there we know you're going to play the maps multiple times. Each playthrough, you can pick up another little bit of the story. For the co-op in Portal 2, we actually wanted you to get everything in the first pass, so that was the difference there. And, you know, the mystery GLaDOS presents is simple. And if you're paying attention, it's pretty obvious. But it's co-op. So it's the fun of going through with your partner. You're making up your own stories. You're going along towards the next human genocide. But, you know, there's also one other major difference between single-player and co-op players that was not obvious to became started playtesting. And that's during testing of both parts of our game, we actually have people sit in a room. They're separated. And we have a camera on the game that they're playing, but we also have cameras looking at their faces so we can see their reactions.
So this is a photo I grabbed off that system of a player actually playing the single-player part of Portal 1. And this is what they look like during the entire part. He's probably watching the funniest section of Portal 1, Portal 2 right now. You can see he's completely stoic and unsmiling. There's no hint that he's enjoying it at all. But when you debrief them afterwards, they're like, that was great, it was super funny. But again, in the moment, they're just staring at the screen, solving puzzles, looking incredibly angry.
So there's this strange thing that happens in co-op. We have people in separate rooms again. They can't see each other. We sometimes test them with no microphones, so they couldn't talk to each other. There's no way they can communicate with each other, and yet they laughed, they smiled, they joked, right? They had all these regular things you have when you're next to someone. Right, all these regular social norms, they carried through into the game, even though they didn't have the communication and the other person couldn't see their face, you know, smiling or laughing. So this is an important takeaway from anyone out there writing a game. If you're going to do a comedy game, make it co-op. Because otherwise you're going to have years of misery and self-doubt as you watch playtesters.
It's awful. It's the darkest thing you can possibly do. So just real quick, we also tried a competitive multiplayer mode which we put together over the space of a month or two, and it was kind of a mix between the old Amiga game, Speedball, and Portal, except with none of the good parts of either of those two things. It was super chaotic, difficult to tell what was going on, and no fun. So the only real good news about this part was that we cut it pretty quickly and were able to use those resources to develop co-op a little bit more.
All right, so in this point in development, we've got this co-op story set. We're on our way with that. We have most of the single-player story set. We just have one major problem. We have no ending to the single-player story. And we had the same struggle when we were making Portal 1. The ending didn't come to really, really late, and that turned out to be one of the highlights of the game. So we had that going for us, but still, at this point, we had no ending.
We did have some things that we knew, though. We knew you were going to have to confront Wheatley. We knew you were going to have to remove him from the GLaDOS chassis. We knew he was going to have to get some sort of comeuppance for causing you all that trouble. And something we knew from Portal 1 was that this final puzzle shouldn't be particularly difficult. This should not be the most difficult puzzle in the game because long, thoughtful puzzle solving is completely not climactic. So, with that knowledge, we were able to at least start designing the final battle and start iterating on that, and that was coming together great. What was missing was any sort of story part to that, which was bad for Jay and Chet and I. And this is a early version of the solution we initially came up with, and it's a slightly different version of the end chamber. You'll recognize some things, but I'll just play it through.
Core, are you ready to start the procedure? Corrupted Core, are you ready to start the procedure? Stalemate detected. Transfer procedure cannot continue. Unless a stalemate associate is present and can press the stalemate resolution button. Press button to replace Core. Stalemate button has been destroyed. Transfer procedure cannot continue. Unless a stalemate associate can say the word yes. Stalemate associate, do you wish to start the transfer?
Yes.
Stalemate resolved. Core transfer initiated.
So, confused? So were all our playtesters. That was Chell speaking, right? The confusion reaction was pretty much all we saw from players not really understanding who was talking, and they're super underwhelmed. I mean, that's the end of the game. And this is the classic idea of, you have this great idea, you're pitching it, it sounds awesome. Oh, my God, Chell's finally going to speak.
Yeah,
where is it going to come out?
One word. She's going to say one word, and it's going to be the one that ends the game.
And then you actually test it.
Boy, did it suck.
Yeah. It sucks.
Boy, that was bad. So this is where we were. There's a release date bearing down on us, and we have no ending. So going back a little bit, at one point earlier in production, we'd had this idea that scattered throughout the game there would be these fake endings. When this rose out of when we were watching Portal 1 playtest, there's a part about two-thirds through the game where you ride an elevator into a fire pit, and you're supposed to escape the fire pit, and that's when you go behind the scenes. But a small percentage of playtesters were just fine with riding the elevator into the fire pit. Like, that was a good ending for them. It was dark, but they liked it. Like, it just ended with them dying. So we thought, well, we'll service those people. And we had these scattered throughout the game, parts where Chell would die, and that would be the end, and we'd play a song, and if you wanted to, you could just quit there. So we had one that was, 2 minutes into the game, and if you died there, there was just a song that I think just Jay and I sang. We hadn't done anything yet. That was just about reviewing those first 2 minutes, kind of wistfully, what had happened. And then later in the game, there was a part where there's a crack in the ceiling, and you could see the moon. And you could put a portal on the moon, and if you put one on the wall, it would suck you out onto the moon, and you would asphyxiate while listening to a sad song about the moon. And that one actually worked. For the people that found it, which was a small percentage of our playtesters, they really liked it. We eventually cut the alternate endings, partly because of how much work it was going to be for how little payoff, and partly because, other than those two, we had kind of overestimated how many great fake endings we were going to be able to come up with. So, anyway, there we were, not long to go until we're really going to have to finish this game and ship, and as Jay and Chet and I, in one of these sort of flop, sweat-soaked ending meetings, trying to figure out desperately what's going to happen, and somebody made the connection that if we resurrected this moon thing, it solved all our problems. Wheatley would get sucked out of the chassis, he'd get a comeuppance that was kind of deserved, but it wasn't really that bad. He's still out there in space. And it was this perfect mix of being totally awesome and completely stupid. So that's what we did. And in retrospect, this is another example that we kept finding of an obvious solution that was just sort of sitting there all along. In fact, it was probably one of the biggest lessons we learned is try to give yourself enough time for the obvious to become obvious, because at a certain point, most of the answers to what you need to do are already buried in what you've already done. So that was the last major puzzle piece. We finished the game, we released it, and then as far as how it turned out, this year there was a pretty clear winner of the most Game of the Year awards, and that was Skyrim. But
pretty clearly we're number two.
No shame in being number two at all.
And that's where we ended.
That's where we ended. We're going to do some Q&A.
So I don't know how
really
Q&A works. Yeah. No questions. Good, we can leave.
I could ask a question.
Oh, damn.
So my question is, thanks for Portal 2 and Old Man Murray. Now, could you say a bit about the role of the writer at Valve, of writers in general?
Part of it is we use the title writer because we need to have a title on our business cards and stuff when people ask, but everyone at Valve has a lot of different roles. And so it really depends on what's going on. I mean, as writers, obviously, we're writing the story, we're writing Reloading, and all the things that need to be in the game. But it's a really collaborative effort at Valve, so everybody weighs in on the writing, and we weigh in on everything else.
Yeah, we try and spread ourselves out in terms of, Chet and I wire, and Jay as well now, wire the dialogue into the game. We don't just kind of throw it over the wall and hope that the game turns out okay, which is especially important for a game that's supposed to be funny because the time, tenth of a second here and there just ruins the gag.
That,
Kind of following up on that, a lot of what made the first Portal special was how well your voice actress understood the material. And there was a real sense of a relationship there. You also took huge strides in Portal 2 by working with J.K. Simmons and Stephen Merchant. Can you talk some about the casting process and the recording process of working with them?
Sure. Is that Tom Chick?
Yes, it is.
No, hey, Tom. Originally, we had cast an actor named Richard Ayoade, who is from the IT crowd, and Garth Marenghi. We were actually having some trouble getting our schedules right, which is when we eventually switched to Stephen Merchant. And we honestly, Jay and I did not think he would do it, because we assumed he was just so wealthy from owning half the office or however much he owns. But we sent him a packet of materials, and he said okay. And we had actually been writing with sort of Stephen Merchant's voice in our head, more so even than Richard Ayoade's. So it ended up being a good fit. And with J.K. Simmons, I think we just always sort of pictured his voice whenever we heard Cave Johnson when we were writing lines. And again, we asked him. It's amazing when you call up an actor's agent, they're more or less willing to do it. And it tends not to be, it's less expensive than you think. I mean, I don't know if it's that way with every actor, but with character actors, they want to work. It's an easy gig for an actor. They don't have to get dressed up. They don't have to go in makeup. They show up for 4 hours and do their work. Stephen Merchant, actually, we did 4.5 sessions with, including the first one where we had to go to London. The rest of them we did ISDN from Seattle. But so we have about 16.5 hours of Stephen Merchant doing stuff. And J.K. Simmons, basically, he read the stuff and nailed it the first time. Stephen Merchant, we kind of let him just, with 16 hours, we let him just sort of mess around with the lines. And he did a lot of improvisation, you know, some of which we used or some of which we would edit together to make a coherent thought after the fact.
Yeah, there's definitely something nice about having actors that you know their voice, that you could write to it directly, instead of a lot of times we'll cast people and you find out they can't say anyone, they can only say anybody, or every actor has some weird hang-up. You can listen enough of their body of work that you can kind of understand what they can do.
I won't name it. We had an actor this is not the world's greatest line, and we stole it from Aliens, but
clearly,
we just wanted him to say, stay frosty. Like,
stay frosty.
Stay frosty. And for some reason, he thought he was telling a dog to say it. Could not read. It's like, stay frosty.
Stay
frosty. And we're like, no, it's like, stay frosty. He's like, oh, I get it. Stay frosty. So
it's
probably just as well that we didn't ship a line from Aliens. But
The other great thing about Stephen Merchant is he speaks so fast. And for a character that's delivering a lot of exposition, that's amazingly awesome.
And
he speaks fast and clearly.
And he really threw himself into it. Like, I don't think he plays a lot of games, and I don't know that he's played Portal 2, but he cared a lot about what was happening. It was terrifying because we didn't have him audition. Like, we were just giving him some money to do it, and we're flying to London, Jay and I, after making this big decision. And if he had sucked or not cared because he was going to, you know, build a new deck on his house, we were super screwed. But he, from, you know, minute two of the session, he was asking questions. He really knocked it out of the park. And then also Ellen McLean, who does GLaDOS, we just record with every couple of weeks, whatever we need. You know, she has a handle on that character. And that's all I have to say about that.
You guys have to fight it out. Who goes? I don't know how this works.
This is a question about your anecdote of the testers, the single-player testers being very frosty and the multiplayer testers being very animated. Do you know if the multiplayer play testers were actually enjoying the experience more, or were they just emoting about it more?
At the end of the play test, when we would have them talk about highs and lows and that kind of thing, they seemed equal. Mm. It seemed exactly on par or equal. We'd started separating them from, like, so way back when I think it first started at Valve, we would actually sit in the room with the playtesters, but then they would perform because they had an audience, and so that's why we would move them to the isolated booths. And the feedback would have been the same for either, you know, the single player or the co-op. They were both having a good time.
Yeah, they're just way more demonstrative in co-op.
When you approach writing a game that will change through iterative design,
Where do you go for like a overall theme? How does that change when you're changing the game so widely with playtest?
In term by theme, what are you referring?
Overall theme of the narrative?
Oh, well, I think we, you know, if we think of the theme as being, so for instance, in Portal, the theme is basically I'm going to have this relationship with GLaDOS. I mean, that's the most important thing to us. So we wanted to make that central, and we wanted these other characters to somehow, whatever we added or whatever events had happened, it needed to kind of deepen your relationship to GLaDOS. So that was there from the beginning and carried through the whole time. We always held on to that. and this isn't really a theme, it's more of a writing rule we had, was that with a silent protagonist, there's this danger that you get into a position where you have a bunch of characters talking about something and you're just sort of observing it and you're standing around just with nothing to do. So one of the rules we had in the writer's room was that the characters needed to always be talking either to you or directly about you, just so you would always feel, even though you couldn't participate in the conversation, that you were the center of attention. Does that generally answer your question?
You said that.
So I really enjoyed exploring the drawings on the walls, and I was just wondering if you could talk about kind of when in the process you guys started thinking about what those would entail, and how deep you went with those, with the, I guess, the physics and the astronomy that you guys included in those, and just generally talk about those. I really found them interesting.
Well, that was kind of as we were expanding the Ratman's role.
Yeah, this is kind of goes back to the thing we were talking about with the elevators, where the elevators got way better looking between the games. Yes. The Ratman got way better at art between the two games, just because we
dedicated an artist.
Yeah,
to
we
it.
Had an artist who could do it, and that's the main reason of that. And some stuff is back solving. So in other words, that was kind of cheap to bring online at the end. So when we decided late that you were going to go to the moon. Well, it was pretty easy to go back and have the Rat Man drawn all sorts of pictures of the moon all over. It makes us look super smart when...
Yeah, and oddly enough, the national song that plays in his den was originally the moon sad song.
Yeah, it was going to... They were going to... The national was going to do the sad song, you know, you had a good time, but you died on the moon sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering... When I was playing, I noticed there were a lot of references to Greek mythology in the story, more so with like Prometheus. I was just wondering what the reason was for putting those
in
the story.
Jay
Pinkerton read some Greek mythology, I think. That's really honestly about the... It was weird. We made the connection one day that... I don't know if this was unconscious or what, that... Basically, what happens to GLaDOS is almost exactly what happened to Prometheus. And so we just added it to the Oracle turret. I think some of the other allusions may be accidental. That's one of the things we discovered, is that when you have a game with enough content, there's just going to be some crazy coincidences that make you look, again, super smart that you may not have planned for. Like Carolyn apparently means free man. Is that right, Jay? But Carolyn also just happens to be the name of Jay's mom, which is why we actually picked that. So, still, worked out.
Thanks.
Do you ever struggle between balancing the comedy and the drama of the piece, like where you had a joke you really liked, but you had to cut it because it was ruining a story beat?
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff we cut. There's a whole set of tracks we cut because of gameplay that we had good beats in, funny stuff.
And there's, we definitely went back and forth on, for instance, the part where GLaDOS is deposed and Wheatley takes over. We originally had some more jokes in there, and we took some of them out, and we still have an ongoing argument where I still feel like when he's going in and he's like, this is going to hurt, isn't it? I wish he was just more scared there. Like, there are times when we're like, let's just not go for the joke here.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of times if you go for the joke there, kind of, you're purposely undercutting the main focus of the that bit of story. So it's a toss-up.
It is something we struggle with.
Hi. So you did sort of start the talk out with this, but I wanted you guys to go in a little more about sort of managing, I guess, fan expectations. So I know I was talking to some of your colleagues around, like, the EP2 time, and they were really nervous about how the hunter was in the teaser trailer, but there wasn't really gameplay around it. And I'm wondering just about, like, you know, if there are any promises you may regret or just, like, things that you revealed about the game before it was done or before it was tested that, you know, just kind of put you in a tough position.
What was the thing you said they cut?
No, not that they cut, but, like, when the hunter in episode two...
Oh, in episode two.
Was in the teaser.
We showed...
The vents.
The suction vents that just never turned into... They I don't know if you remember it. It was... We presented it as a puzzle mechanic, and you could break a tube or something, and suction would come out, and you could redirect the suction through portals. It was super cool, but we just never really found a great puzzle use for it.
Well, except for the end.
Yeah, the mitigating factor is we did use it in the end when you get sucked onto the moon, but we didn't really make it into a puzzle.
But, I mean, that happens with all the games we've ever shown at any event. I mean, there's still people that are swearing that Left 4 Dead 1, the beta that we showed at this event, was the greatest version of that game ever. But the truth always is, there's always a little bit of smoke and mirrors going on there, and really the best version is the version we shipped. There's not at some point we go, this is a really cool thing, let's get rid of it. Yeah. No, it's like, there's a bunch of problems, it's not really working as well as you think it is, and so what we end up shipping is going to be the thing that, you know, we made the best choices on.
Yeah, I mean, people ask us sometimes, or, well, not so much anymore, but some of the promotional videos we originally did for Portal 2 showed some test chambers that didn't really make it into the final game. But a lot of those weren't even decent puzzles. They were just something there to show off a mechanic. Some people still think that they're going to be great puzzles and want to know why we cut them. The good news is we're going to release a puzzle creator pretty soon so they can try and recreate them themselves and find out how bad they were.
Thanks.
Yes, I was just wondering what decisions led to the potato, both from this purpose it served narratively, but also just why a potato?
So Jay and I would take these long walks trying to figure out what we were going to do with the story. And we knew GLaDOS was going to get deposed, and she was going to have to come with you. And we were trying to figure out what was the most humiliating thing that could happen to her. And we figured turning her into a potato battery was pretty bad. And then I think Jay said potatoes, and then it was kind of a sealed deal because we had a name for it. And it just seemed super sad that she would be in this shriveled, crappy little potato. And you could put it on the gun, and...
Tiny Mike.
Yeah, we originally also had this idea, this is another reason it was a potato, was the bird was going to play a bigger role. So, because we knew we were going to need to explain later on why she wouldn't just tell you how to solve the puzzles that Wheatley had set up for you. And so our thought was the bird, every couple of chambers, was going to come in and attack the potato and eat part of it. And she was going to keep getting stupider and stupider as you went along. There was a couple problems with that in that we didn't want her to get stupider. That was funnier when we said it than when we actually tried to write it. And then it also turns out that it's actually a big honking deal to get a bird to fly in and attack your view model. And so people were like, are you sure this is going to be a lot of work? But it was good because it actually just drove us to the much simpler solution, which is they've got this hardwired thing that if they try and tell you the answer to the puzzle, they have this physical, like, pain reaction to it, which was just a way easier solution. And the bird was in there plenty still.
Thanks.
Did all those hours spent watching testers test ever make you feel like GLaDOS?
Yeah, it is.
But also, it gets you nauseous.
Yeah,
it's tough. Portal's a tough one to watch.
Yeah, motion sickness. But it is kind of just a giant... analogy for actual how we make the games is what GLaDOS does. So yeah.
So your experience in game design sort of informed the concept of the story, like this huge testing lab.
A little bit, some of it. I mean, I know that when Wheatley makes his first test chamber, I think it was Phil Coe maybe made that, and he just used like the standard thing that everybody does when they first make a level, which is to just make this big box with the word test on it or their name or something. So, yeah, in some ways, that, you know, Wheatley was this kind of neophyte level designer.
Thank you.
How do you guys generate your scripts? Do you each take a mission, or do you bounce them back and forth? Do you lock yourself in a room and say, no one's getting out of here until we have the level
three? It depends. It depends where we are in the process,
yeah,
what we're working on.
How far away we are from a recording session. If it's, like, 3 weeks, we're not doing anything. If it's 3 days... Yeah, we're sweating it. And we tend to sit in a room, more so now. We've been getting more in this sort of writer's room kind of thing where We'll bring our ideas, we'll try and hash them out all together, and then maybe separate and just sort of smooth everything out.
Especially when you're doing the jokes. If the jokes aren't making anyone in the room laugh, they're not going to work.
Yeah.
Right? It's a good first test.
You get kind of punchy, and then seem like they're working, and then
they're horrible.
And then they don't. But a lot of it is a group write, where we sit down and we map out what needs to get written, you know, where dialogue needs to be, and then we just try and as a group go through it.
As I was playing Portal 2, I felt it was a really clear example of this kind of hero's journey kind of story with three acts, and especially the player descending in this sort of underworld in the second act. So can you say something about how intentional this was?
Well, we certainly wanted our hero to go on a journey.
And I mean, we definitely, there's a structure of storytelling, right? I mean, three acts is pretty standard. We didn't really reinvent anything there, and it seemed to fit pretty well.
Yeah, part of the thing with going into the underground was Portal 1 starts with you waking up and feeling very alone. And Portal 2 didn't start that way because for various reasons, but we still wanted to have an area where you did feel like you were now alone in a place you didn't understand, which is why when you get dropped down that pit, we give you a while to just sort of take it in, you know, after having basically been accompanied by someone the entire time. But I don't know that there was any conscious hero's journey sort of thing going on.
Thanks.
What do the lights mean? Can we keep... Oh. We have two more questions, right? We can do those. Right. Is that all right? Yeah.
Valve has a pretty
timely
awesome
shirt, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's just a Street Fighter shirt. Valve has got a pretty awesome reputation for releasing free content. And so I'm just wondering, have you ever considered releasing Michael's version of Wheatley? Like his entire, assuming he did.
He didn't do that. He did, not everything's covered. Game.
Oh, no. We didn't none of the stuff after Wheatley takes over, except for maybe a couple times when we didn't have merchant stuff, we'd bring Richard back in. But it would be a huge, huge undertaking.
Got it. I assumed you already had the audio track.
No. And the other problem is it would need to match the timing of the merchant line,
so
or else it would be like 10 times more.
Never.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah. So that's not. Yeah. Yeah. Let's not go there. All right. Thank you.
But thank you.
So the two big memes that came out of the first Portal were the cake and the companion cube. And I want to commend you guys for not going back to that well in the second game. But was it ever really tempting to just go for that layup and bring those back? Or were there people in Valve who were like, we got to have the companion cube. People loved it.
Well, the companion cube is back. So I don't know if you're setting me up to...
Sorry.
The companion cube is there. We don't focus on it a lot. We felt like that we could bring back in a sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word,
funny way.
The cake, I think we make one reference to. But no, nobody was really pushing us to do it. We just knew, we were pretty confident that we could just come up with a story that didn't rely on that. And, we figured people had lived with the cake jokes enough that they probably...
Yeah, that is the thing though, right? So we were talking about it. Internally, we lived with GLaDOS this whole time. And so for us, not that we're sick of her, but we had lived with her a lot, and we're thinking maybe we should try something new. But everybody lived with the cake is a lie jokes, right? I think we all had our share of those.
Yeah, it was
great.
We didn't
need to go back.
Nobody pressured us. And honestly, I've never had anybody come up and say, I wish there was more cake in the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have anything left for a third one?
Maybe.
No. No, so honestly, it's like with when we also do why it takes us so long for DLC. We don't worry or think about that. Holding something back because you think you're going to run out of ideas, don't ever do that. Just go. Just put it all in. You know what? You're going to have those horrendous days of the ending where you're just staring at each other thinking there's no way you're going to come up with anything. And you do.
Yeah, there's some way to solve it.
So don't hold back.
Yeah, and also one of our goals was to not have a cliffhanger ending. We wanted... we felt like Portal had this nice, satisfying ending, and we wanted Portal 2 to feel the same way. At the end, there were some unresolved questions, but it felt like everybody had their end.
Yep. So I think that's it.
Is that it?
So thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much.